There's only one reason I invite a guest back to the Good Glow, and that's because I know what they have to say is so important, it's going to make a real difference. And so, this is the Good Glow podcast with Millie McIntosh. This season of the Good Glow is brought to you with thanks to Electrocell, a simple way to keep on top of your hydration. Not just for athletes, Electrocell is for anyone who wants an easy way to stay hydrated. Whether you're at work, out for a walk, or just getting on with your day, it can also be used to stay hydrated in hot weather. Available in three flavours, there's always one that's perfect for you with a mix of key electrolytes like sodium, potassium and magnesium. Find Electrocell at your local pharmacy or visit electrocell.ie for more. Electrocell is a food supplement and should not replace a balanced diet. Always read the label before use. Okay, so from the outside looking in, it looks like Millie McIntosh has it all. Beautiful kids, a gorgeous husband, a picture-perfect life. But today, Millie tells me, behind the curtain, she was a bad drunk. Millie had convinced herself she didn't have a problem, often numbing herself with alcohol and tablets. But 3 years ago, things got so bad, Millie knew she had a decision to make. Today, we talk about her rock bottom. She bravely opens up about photos that were taken by the press that nearly broke her. Her relationship with her ex-husband, Professor Green. Going to her first AA meeting and how speaking her truth has finally set her free. I too open up about what I identified to be my problem with alcohol and how I addressed it. I'm blown away by Millie's openness today. And there is a trigger warning. There's a brief moment in this podcast where Millie mentions having suicidal thoughts. I've left important phone numbers in the show notes. Millie McIntosh, welcome to the Good Glow. How are you?
Oh, like, thank you for having me back. I always feel really excited when I know I've got you in my diary. So I've been really excited to chat to you and have a bit of a catch up.
Yeah, for all the people listening, you know, we hit it off the first time we recorded a podcast together. I remember feeling so nervous because I didn't know if you were going to open up on the episode. And you did. And it was just, I know so many people in Ireland who were already fans of you and watched you on Made in Chelsea were just like, whoa, like Millie has stepped into her power. But you've continued to do that, like even since that conversation 2 years ago. Look at how far you've come. Like, how are you feeling these days as the version of yourself that you are now?
I mean, it has been... yeah, a really transformative few years. And I have to say, I'm in the best place I think I've ever been in at the moment. I have been sober for nearly 3 years now. And yeah, been really on a journey with my, you know, self-development and self-love and improving my mental health. And yeah, stopping drinking really was the key for me, that really started me off on my healing journey, which I thought I was on before, but actually getting to know myself and having a lot more awareness. And yeah, it's been a bumpy ride at times, but I'm feeling really good. And yeah, I've done the book and it's been just amazing seeing the response.
Reading your book, Bad Drunk, first of all, when I heard the title, I was like, whoa, she's going for it. So yeah. Like, tell us, why is it called Bad Drunk?
So when it came to choosing a name, I was just trying to write down like words that really summed up like how I was as a drinker. And when I wrote Bad Drunk, I was like, oh, it's too much. Like, it's too honest. It's too revealing. It's too self-deprecating. Like, can I do that? And then I was just, but I also just instantly knew that was it. But I was kind of scared and the publishers loved it. So we did it. We called it Bad Drunk. And that pretty much just sums me up as a drinker. I was always a bad drunk from my teens onwards. I never could find that limit. And I tried to drink responsibly, but once I'd had one, it was just like something was ignited inside of me. And I wanted to drink and drink and drink until I reached a point of blackout, and it was a very toxic relationship for me.
You're sitting in your gorgeous new house. You've got the most stunning green wallpaper I've ever seen in my life. You're wearing a green cardigan, and it's actually the week before St. Patrick's Day in Ireland, which is such, you know, it's a day of drinking, you know, and it historically has been, you know, a day where we give ourselves permission to go out and get hammered. So tell us about a bad drunk, and what were you like as a bad drunk?
So yeah, but I'd also start by saying, see, I don't judge people for drinking, and I do think people can drink in a way that is non-destructive. So there are lots of people out there that are good drunks, or that can handle their alcohol, that can know their limit and can drink responsibly and enjoy it, and it doesn't cause them problems. So that is, I have like no judgment for anyone who drinks, whether they drink a lot, whether they drink occasionally. Like, it's I just am looking out after like myself, so there's zero judgment for what anyone else is doing. But a bad drunk for me is somebody who, well, like, I can only talk about my own experience, which was often really setting myself like a plan in my head, like, okay, I'm not going to drink too much. I'm only going to drink, you know, three drinks the whole night. I'm going to have water in between. I'm going to finish drinking by 9 p.m. I'm only going to drink one type of alcohol. I'm not going to mix my drink. All these rules. And as soon as I'd had one or two, they would just all disappear. And I would feel at the beginning, you know, that initial like buzz of the alcohol. And then I would just keep chasing that feeling, and I would just want to drink more and more and more. I'd be ordering another drink when I still had a drink in my hand. I'd finish a drink before everyone else had, you know, even had like two sips. I'd be on to the next one and the next one and the next one. And my hangovers were also really severe from early on. And so I was very easily affected by alcohol, but then also very like, I really am a sensitive person, and I would really feel the after effects of the hangover, and they would, you know, really affect me for days on end. And sometimes I'd drink through it to try and cope with the hangover, but it was, I mean, that was always a really bad idea. And the anxiety for me was something I just couldn't ignore anymore, because I would feel so much more anxious after drinking, and I knew it was linked, but I would also drink because I felt anxious to help me feel more comfortable. So I had, from the age of, as a teenager, learned to feel comfortable socially by drinking. And because drinking at pretty much every social occasion is so normalized, in a lot of cultures, but particularly in our culture, I found it very difficult to break free from drinking in this, you know, all these social functions, because I just was crippled by social anxiety. And it wasn't until I stopped drinking that I actually had to, you know, do the work to really work out why I was so uncomfortable, and to, yeah, like figure out how to live life without this crutch.
Wow. There's so much of that that's going to resonate with so many people. And I think what I loved in the book is that when you say that people, other mums, come up and tap you on the shoulder at Pilates, or they share their story with you, it's a real, it feels like, would I say a dark secret? Maybe that's too strong a term, but it seems like it's an unspoken thing between mums, that maybe a lot of mums are uncomfortable with how much they drink at the weekends.
Yeah, I do think it carries so much shame and stigma still to say, I have a drinking problem. And that's one of the things that kept me stuck for so long, because I felt that, like, okay, I don't maybe fit the mold of what you would think of when you think of an alcoholic, because I'm not drinking every morning and all day, every day, but I was drinking in a destructive way, you know, most weekends, or even towards the end, it was like maybe only once or twice a month. But when I had that first drink, it all just unraveled really quickly. And I just couldn't deny that I had a problem. But for so many years, people would say to me, yeah, you get too wasted or whatever, but you don't have a problem. So whenever someone would kind of say to me like, yeah, but you don't have a problem. So that would just make me think, okay, having a problem is not acceptable. And it just fed into the feeling of shame. And I think shame is really one of those feelings that causes you to want to drink or self-medicate in some way, because it's such a heavy weight to carry. You get into this spiral.
Yeah.
And then you're kind of drinking more to cope with the problems that alcohol's causing you. And it's like this impossible toxic cycle.
Yeah, it's just numbing yourself. We're going, oh, I'll be fine. Like, I won't think about this. I'll just have a few wines and I'll be fine. And then also, I think when people are saying to you, well, you don't have a problem, because they're worried, like, if you have a problem, does that mean I have a problem? You know, so let's all just tell ourselves we don't have a problem. Tell me about the time that you stopped. Like, was it one particular moment?
In the year before I stopped, I'd say there was about three moments where I was like, okay, this is really not good. Like, kind of warning signs. One was on a hen weekend in Ibiza, and I was just felt so broken after two nights in a row of drinking that I felt like I wanted to jump out a window. And I really was, you know, having thoughts of jumping out a window, and that was really confronting.
Wow.
Be like, you know, that was just a really dark place to be in. And, you know, I had young children. Like, I felt so much guilt as well because I'd put myself in that situation. And after that time, one of my best friends said to me, like, I just can't see you do this to yourself anymore. And her words really stuck with me, but it still, like, wasn't enough to make me stop. It was just all in the back of my mind. And then I was at a wedding and I got just absolutely paralytic. Can't remember much of the night. It's all a bit of a blur, but I was just so horrified by the way I'd acted, and I had a huge fight with my husband. And then about 5 days later, we were away on holiday and I was still drinking, and I had a massive panic attack one morning when I was hungover. And during that panic attack, I really believed I was dying and felt like I was moments from death. And I thought, like, to myself, like, I would never see my children again. So when I had calmed down, I had to just have a really honest conversation with Hugo, and I knew I wouldn't have had that panic attack if I hadn't been drinking, and, you know, the night before and the weekend before. And at that point, I just knew something had to change. That was my, you know, that was my moment where I said, I'm never going to drink again. And that was in August. It will be 3 years.
Millie, thank you for just opening your heart and just being so honest. Like, that is so, that must be so hard for you to say out loud everything that you've just said. Like, when you had those thoughts of like doom, was that remembering things that you had done while you were drinking, or was it because of anxiety from maybe historical things that were brought up when you had a hangover?
I think, yeah, when I was hungover, I would feel a mixture of shame, like, how did I get so drunk? Like, and then often anxiety about what I'd done when I was drunk and who had seen.
Okay.
And, you know, how did I behave? Did people take pictures? You know, we were like out in a public place, like, you know, and I couldn't remember chunks of the day and evening where I'd been really wasted. So then I'm freaking out. Did someone video me looking wasted? Did someone take pictures? You know, is that gonna, am I gonna get a Google alert at any moment telling me that's online? And that fear is like, you know, like, if my agent like called me, I'd literally be like, oh my God, like, you know, just constantly living in that paralyzing place of fear of like, I'm going to get caught. And then also like since becoming a mom, I would definitely have the feelings of like guilt of like, how could I drink so much or lose control because I'm now a mom and I don't want to be, this isn't how I want to act and show up in the world. But I would just feel so ashamed and kind of angry at myself, and then just beat myself up a lot about it, which didn't also help.
There's an 11 year age gap between me and my little brother, Sam. And I remember like me and all my friends used to go out and get absolutely hammered. One of us would inevitably be carried home in a taxi. And Sam wasn't drinking like that. And I remember saying to him, God, you guys are just so sensible. And like, why? And he said, well, because of phones. You know, the fear of somebody taking a video of you. So I can imagine that makes sense now. You're in the public eye. Somebody takes a video of you and cancel culture, and your career is done. Everything you've worked for.
But it has happened to me. So in my 20s, you know, I'd finished Made in Chelsea. I got married to someone in the public eye. Then I got divorced, and all of that played out in the tabloids. So when I reconnected with my now husband, Hugo, we were photographed at the Monaco Grand Prix, which is a very, you know, prestigious event. But also, you know, there's press everywhere. And I just ultimately self-sabotaged. I was feeling incredibly anxious. I was going through this massive life change where I separated from my ex-husband, and then I'd rekindle things with Hugo, and I wasn't in a good place and was self-medicating a lot with alcohol and prescribed sedatives often at the same time, which is a really bad idea. And the press got pictures of me that I'll never be able to escape. They'll always be there, and it's out there for, like, my kids will see it. Like, it's mortifying, but also it's like the greatest reminder for me now why I don't pick up a drink.
Getting the alerts the next day, knowing those photos were all over the internet, that's your rock bottom, is it?
Yeah, I only, like, looking back, wish it had been the moment I realized I needed to stop drinking, because the truth is at that point and at that age, what it taught me was to not get caught. So wow. I was like, right, I can't get wasted in public. I have to just do it privately. Yeah.
That is such an aha moment. Yeah. How many of us can relate to that? It's like you're not looking at the root cause and saying, okay, I need to sort out my life. Mm. I need to change. You're like, I was such an idiot for getting photographed like this.
I was like, can't get caught. But the truth is, the shame I felt about the event and getting caught, like, caused me to self-medicate even more. You know, what did I do the moment I saw the pictures? I took two Xanax, and then that day continued drinking all day and all night, but made sure no one took a picture. Like, it just...
Oh, we always have to learn the hard way, Millie. And you've had such an amazing transformation and evolvement of who you are as a person. Talk to us about your 20s and like the Made in Chelsea era. Well, first of all, were you made in Chelsea? Like, were you born in Chelsea?
No, I was actually born in Swindon Hospital in Wiltshire, where I was my parents lived in Wiltshire and in the middle of the countryside, and I moved to London when I was 18. So I definitely was not, although my parents did have a house in Chelsea when they were first married, but when I was born, I could have been made in Chelsea, to be honest, but
you didn't ask.
I haven't asked. But I was born in the countryside, grew up in the countryside, but moved to London when I was 18. And when I was first filming the show, I was living in Fulham. So I would get the bus up the King's Road to filming, and then they'd film me getting out of Bentley. So, you know, it was constructed reality. I don't think many of the cast actually lived in Chelsea, to be honest.
Have you stayed in touch? Because obviously Spencer's on a sober journey, or he's got his alcohol-free brand, and he's in, mad into his health and fitness. And he was Hugo's best friend on the show, wasn't he?
I know. Yeah, they're still really good friends. I see him, Spencer, quite often because we go to the same gym. And yeah, it's I think it's amazing what he's done with his brand, and, you know, really turning things around for himself as well. It's, you know, I think it's interesting seeing, you know, what we've all done with our lives, like, since the show. And I think quite a few of us were, you know, problem drinkers, and being on a show like that only, you know, is going to make the problem worse, because there's all this additional pressure. You're suddenly in the public eye. You are going to all these events where there's open bars, and drinking is kind of really encouraged as part of just that kind of lifestyle.
You even got married so young, and there's a lovely moment in the book, or maybe you said it in an interview, that you say with your ex, like, you have a nice relationship and you've sent pictures of your kids and things, but you were both probably going through your own mental health problems at the time, and maybe that's what brought you together, but too young probably.
I think we were both really just drawn to each other because we could see the trauma in each other, like, thinking, you know, we could kind of heal each other or fix each other. We can look back on it now, and I think it's really nice to reach a place where there's no bad blood or bad feelings, and you can both appreciate how much you've both grown and into different people. And we're no longer the people that we were then.
Mm. And you got back together with Hugo, your childhood sweetheart, and he was really instrumental in you becoming sober and helping you through that really difficult time. Because I would feel that, or I would presume that a lot of people might be afraid to say to their partner that they want to give up drinking because they fear it might change their relationship for the worse.
I would say it means there's nowhere to hide. So any issues in the relationship become glaringly obvious because you're not self-medicating, there's like less distraction. But I think that's only a positive thing, because then you're actually able to go, okay, where are these issues? Like, what do we need to change? And we did therapy, and I think therapy is super helpful for people to do on their own, but then also together, and to really, you know, get to the bottom of what the issues were. For us, it was like a lot of communication and having kids, and it just really changed things. And we both have done a lot of our own healing separately, which I think has really helped us to get to a place where we just know each other so well. You know, it's not easy, marriage. Like, that's why so many marriages don't work. Like, it's hard work. You have to put in the work.
And I think as well, like, for the demographic you have, and like you said, like, the Pilates, the young, gorgeous couple, the, like, beautiful family, gorgeous house, for you to come forward and say marriage isn't easy really helps people drop their shoulders a little bit and maybe stop trying to maybe lie to themselves, put on a front. It just allows people to be more human. Were you ever afraid that you giving up drink could actually tear you guys apart? Or did you know that actually if you kept going, you would just get further and further apart?
What I knew for sure was that if I kept drinking, it was going to end the relationship. And so I knew that no matter what the outcome was, if I was sober and doing the work on myself, that I would be, you know, really trying everything and trying my best to be the best version of myself. And then I could be the best person, the best wife possible, and show up in the relationship how I wanted to show up. Yeah, it's been really life-changing and definitely helped with just our connection. And we did some work with an intimacy coach last year, which really helped on the way we were communicating. Yeah.
Okay, and so like an intimacy coach, I know nothing about them. Like in Ireland, we hide everything behind the couch and the curtains. So like what sort of work do you do with an intimacy coach?
The couples course is a lot about how you are showing up in the relationship, how, and it's always really a lot to do with communication.
Okay.
And it was a lot to do with like things like, you know, things that you're holding on to that even from like past relationships that you bring into your current relationship and just blocks that you have. And it was a lot of sharing and holding space for each other and just like eye contact and, you know, just like a lot of just, you know, very basic things, just like, but just like touching, like non-sexual, just being really present. It kind of like quite mindfulness practices that you would do together.
I love that, because you can live with someone and not actually look at them in the eye. I say to Jamie all the time, I was like, can you make eye contact with me when I'm talking to you?
We went on holiday recently and I bought these like a deck of intimacy cards. And then when we were having dinner, I would be like, we need to like, let's talk about these, like pull a card and then you'd have to talk about the topic.
Okay.
I think it's really good, because otherwise it's so easy just to talk about the kids or just to talk about work or to not actually be like, you know, you've got to remember like person, like if you didn't, you know, when you were first in a relationship with them, and try to get to this place where you're, you know, you forget to ask these deeper questions when you're so familiar with someone.
A short break to thank Electrosolve for supporting the Good Glow this season. So what do electrolytes actually do? Well, I've got the New York Half Marathon around the corner and I've been taking mine every day. The good news is you don't have to be an athlete to take them. They simply help you stay hydrated by helping your body absorb and retain water, keeping you energized and refreshed, as often essential electrolytes can be lost due to exercise, hot weather, travel and other factors. Electrosol is available in flavors such as blackcurrant, lemon and raspberry and orange. It's vegan friendly, gluten free, caffeine free and GMO free. So pop into your local chemist or find even more information on electrosal.ie. The last time you were on the podcast, you said you were in your roommate phase with Hugo. And I said I was in my roommate phase with Jamie. And I got so many messages from people.
Really?
Who were like, thank you so much for saying that, because I am too. My roommate has even moved out of my bedroom. Jamie's in a different room at the moment because of Tali.
Yeah.
Now, we have... she sleeps beside me in the cot and it's just easier, but a week turns into a month, turns into a few more months. So we are actively now working on getting Tali into her own room. And Jamie's been so patient and amazing and I'm grateful to him, you know, for that. But he also is like, I'm off for full night sleep.
Honestly, if I had my way, would sleep with both children in the bed with me and the dog every night. And Hugo would have his own room. Like, on that's honestly like what I want, because
yeah, same.
I love the kids in the bed. I love that, like, the dog is not allowed upstairs, but like I just want to be all cuddled up. And like when we go on holiday is like the only time we really do that. Mm-hmm. And you don't always get the best night's sleep, but I love being asleep with my kids in the bed. It just feels like so safe.
And it feels like a moment in time. They're going to be like teenagers before we know it. But the honesty about your relationship with Hugo is refreshing and genuinely helping people. And how does he feel about you sharing so much? Is he okay with that?
We talk about it. You know, there's definitely a line, but there's, you know, there's certain podcasts and stuff that I listen to, which I love, but I'm like, I can't go into like full depth, you know, sex life chat, because people always ask me like, does Hugo drink and how do I find that? And he definitely drinks a lot less than he used to and a lot less frequently, but he has never been a problem drinker in that I've very rarely seen him act like a different person when he's drunk or be inebriated to the point of like not being in control of himself. Like, he doesn't get to that point.
Yeah.
And he can easily just have one and leave it, or like one or two. And yeah, he just did like dry Jan, and then we were on holiday, he didn't drink. So we're both in a place where we just want to look after ourselves and feel good, like sleep well, wake up, have energy for the kids, look after ourselves, go to the gym, we're more into going to a like sound bath together on the weekend, or we go and get like reflexology and like go out for sushi, and that's like our like date.
So amazing. I love it. I have to say, you've helped me change my relationship with alcohol. So
amazing.
I will now go out and order a non-alcoholic cocktail. I think for me, I recognized my problem with drinking was I would get somewhere and feel nervous and chug the Prosecco. Mm-hmm. You know, it's the drinks reception.
And it's that first part of the event always, right? Like that first half an hour where you're the most uncomfortable.
Yeah. And you're nervous, you're self-conscious, you know, like I'm the type of person, I act weird sometimes, you know, so I'm trying to like be normal. So I'm like, okay, I'll have a few Proseccos and that will take the edge off and that will calm me down. And then I was waking up with hangovers. And I remember Jamie said to me a couple of years ago, he was like, you need to seriously, when you're out, not drink as much because you are so anxious for 3 days after you go out. So now, since I spoke to you and since I've, you know, followed your journey, I'll go out and I'll have a non-alcoholic mojito with no sugar, which you recommended to me.
Yeah, so good.
So delicious. I'll have that or I'll have a sparkling water. And it's so tempting to go for the Prosecco. But I was able to, after watching and studying everything you were doing, to see that that was my problem. And it's, I swear to God, it's life changing. So I think it's about analysing like what you're doing. Are you mindlessly drinking? Yeah. Are you just knocking the drinks back for the sake of it?
Totally, because it's such a habit, you know, and it's like the go-to. And then I was always so easily tempted if someone else said, don't be boring, you know, come on, just have one. And it was never just one. But as soon as somebody, it was like the people pleaser in me as well, I think, that felt like people expected me to be the fun, wild party girl. So I felt like, okay, that's the character that people expect. So I've got to show up as that.
Mm. So like, would your close circle have known? Like, so obviously Hugo knew that the day after you'd be anxious and you felt like you were the drunk girl at the party. But do you think your wider circle knew that when you showed up, you were going to be smashed?
Yeah, it would be like Millie will be the crazy one that will do something stupid and have like a funny story the next day or not be able to remember going to bed. Or yeah, I kind of set myself up as, you know, that wild one. And I would always be cancelling things the next day, you know, whether it was a friend's baby shower or christening lunch, whatever it was, I would often feel too guilty to not show up. And I'd maybe go and then my anxiety would be so bad, I'd have a panic attack and leave. And there was countless events like that where and it would always be something public, like going somewhere to some kind of thing. And when I'd gone out the night before, I just would be just dying inside and would either leave or would just drink through it to reach a place of drunkenness again where I could forget about my hangover.
Mm. And all the work you've done, and you are doing the work. So did you have to go back and look at the symptom? Like, why am I doing this?
Absolutely. I think that's the key for anyone. And that's going to stop you going back to whatever you're addicted to, because, or whatever you're using to numb yourself, because you've got to go deep and start looking at, okay, what are those reasons? What are those things that have happened to me in my life that have caused me to feel anxious, to feel low about myself, to have low self-esteem, to have low self-worth, and having that deeper understanding of myself has helped me to carry a lot less shame about the way I've acted.
Yeah,
there's obviously things I wish that hadn't happened and things I wish I could go back and change, but ultimately all the things that I've done have made me who I am. And yeah, I can be a lot kinder to myself about. So it was like I could, when I reached a certain level of drunkenness, it was like I was turning down a dial on all my thoughts, and it was like But now I've realized there's much healthier ways that I can do that.
Yeah.
Like, you know, even just like exercise or going to, I went to this really fun thing the other day called Sanctum, which we should do if you're over in London. It's like a kind of workout, but it's like a kind of yogic meditation to music at the same time. And yeah, it's really fun.
Oh, I love that. And I'm so excited for everything that you're doing. And it's just amazing. Do you look at things with a different lens?
I feel like there's, like I've let go of this thing that was really holding me back.
Yeah.
So, that, you know, the, it's like opened life up, like the possibilities are endless, but there's still work to do daily. And I'm actually going to my first AA meeting this week. And I have just decided I actually want to try it and see if it's for me because I like the idea of the community aspect. Now that I'm like further into it, like having meeting more sober people, I've got a couple of sober friends already, but I'm just like, you know, I think doing the step work will actually be really helpful in terms of the emotional sobriety, and the work that I'm really aware that I need to do is with feeling my feelings. And I'm very good at not feeling my feelings, either by trying to control everything or by being so busy that I'm not able to stop and really feel. So that's what I'm like kind of, and I, and like some body image stuff that is like my next big thing as well that I need to really get, like I keep kind of going near it and then I'm like, oh, do I really, you know, I've been carrying it around for so many years. So that's kind of my, I'm like very aware of my stuff.
Yeah. And the more you crack yourself open, the more shit you probably find that you have to deal with. Oh, it's so annoying.
Yeah.
It's just a never ending journey, isn't it? But that's just, whoa, so many things going through my mind there. So first of all, I had a guy, actually, I must send you his book, Mark Meegan. If there was an Irish maid in Chelsea, he would have been on it, you know. And he spoke to me on my podcast and he said, my privilege actually made me feel a little bit uncomfortable with my addiction because it was like people said, sure, you bloody had it all. Like you can't put yourself in the category of being an addict. And he broke through that, you know, and is flying the flag for so many people in Ireland. And I feel like as a woman in AA, that is one step further for you to say that, because I think maybe we think AA is for men or really bad drunks, excuse the pun with your book, but that's huge. Tell us about that.
I think, you know, there's such an outdated view of what an addict or alcoholic is. And there's lots of different ways you can get help, whether I saw a sober coach for a while, which really helped me. But I think what appeals with going to some kind of group, you know, there's AA, there's lots of different ones, is just the connection and you know, connecting with other sober people who have all got different stories and just, you know, building that community feeling. And that it, you don't have to be drinking vodka in your orange juice at breakfast and passing out on your doorstep and to have completely lost everything to go to one of these meetings or to go to a sober coach or to just, you know, pick up my book or listen to a podcast or whatever it is. We almost feel like you have to have a really bad problem to be able to ask for help. Like you have to be completely broken by it and have lost everything and before you're in that category. If alcohol is causing you a problem, then that's enough of a problem to get help for it. And there's to be no shame in that, because like I read something like if you're addicted to cigarettes and people blame the nicotine. If you're addicted to alcohol, people blame the person.
Wow.
Right?
That's huge.
When you let that sink in.
And exactly what you said, you don't have to be in the gutter with a bottle of vodka. It's curiosity. And that actually, if you allow yourself to be curious, it can transform your life. Because for so many years before I got sick, I was not curious. I was like, I like my life. I go out at the weekends and I go hell for leather. And then I work all week long. And I didn't think there was another option because I didn't know another world existed because I was not curious, because I didn't open my mind to other ways. And to be curious about AA or community or connecting with people, like the step that that brings you to next is beyond anything you probably could have imagined for yourself. Millie, I could talk to you like forever and ever.
Me too.
You are such a positive person in my life. When you're in my phone texting me and just opening your arms to me, but also when I'm an observer from the outside in, like just looking at your socials every day and reading your book, Bad Drunk, it's out now. It's beautiful and such a reflection of how far you've come, and I hope you're so proud of yourself.
Oh, thank you. I feel just really grateful, to be honest, at the moment, like just really feeling that gratitude for the just, you know, and my family, like our home, our life, just being in a position where I've come out the other side of this challenge and I can now share my experience from a place of positivity and try to empower people to make this change for themselves and, you know, change their lives for the better.
And you are doing that every day and it's incredible to watch. So keep going, and thanks for taking us on the journey. Wow. Millie McIntosh, Nicola Haney, Sarah Corbett Lynch. Can I just say, on a week where we celebrate women all over the world, how grateful I am for the women I've spoken to this season on The Good Glow. Huge thank you to Millie for today's podcast. I know this season is making a real difference. I've been stopped in the parks, supermarkets, at my corporate talks. I know that the first few episodes of this season have blown so many of you away, and that is because of my incredible guests, the stories they're telling. You know, together we'll make a difference. Together we can create this safe space to tell our stories, and together we can grow stronger. A huge shout out to all the strong women in my life, my mum, my daughters, my mother-in-law Hazel, my sisters Kira, Sophie, Julie and Jean, my besties, my soul sisters. The list goes on. And to each and every single one of you, I am so forever grateful.